Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at cenovus.com.
Welcome, everybody, to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your wrong host, Mark Bigney, and with me is my wrong co-host, Michael Walker. How you doing, Walker?
So wrong.
Very wrong. I would just like a brief update from something we talked about last week. I said that Trick Takers was thus far only available in Japanese. That is false. The English edition has very recently been released.
There's many Trick Takers in English, like Marshmallow Test and lots of others.
Thanks, Walker.
Crew.
I appreciate yeah. So I apologize for the error. I encourage you to try Trick Takers in English if you're at all curious about what I had to say, but were perhaps put off by the prospect of having to use translations, because you don't have to. So we're going to talk about board games this week. We're going to talk about the games we played this week. We're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And we're going to talk about our feature game this week. Our feature game is Act 1 of Fateforge Chronicles of Khan by Mighty Boards and Gordon Kalea. So Walker, what did you play last week?
Mark, we streamed a game called Snow Planner, therefore, once again, emptying my shelf of shame.
Good job.
This is designed by Akashi and self-published, and you are sort of filling up your hotel with people. You don't really...
Guests, I'm hoping.
Guests.
Because there's lots of other ways you could fill up a hotel with people, and it would not be a sort of cozy experience.
It'd be a little baity, yes.
A little bit.
And then the guests have needs, and if you fulfill those needs... then they'll stay longer, and so they sort of slide up and they start giving you better and better stuff the longer they stay. And so stuff they need is like fancy things in the hotel or you know, better snow on the hills, or just, you know, stuff that you can acquire. Unfortunately, the combination of the translation of the rule book and the cards themselves is so bad, it is borderline unplayable.
I remember when you, because you've had this for a while, a few months, trying to get it to the table, which is hardly something new for us based on the volume of games we choose to play. But in this particular case, you were daunted by the fact that you had kept going back to the rulebook and finding it difficult based on the phrasing of a variety of things.
The physical rulebook, there was some copy and paste where some things were just said twice. At least the online one, that's out, but still the translation is awful. I put it this way, long story short, it is bad. And the game itself is not too bad because it is a dice worker placement. I enjoy dice worker placement games. You're getting croissants. Croissants are very important when you ski, Mark. If you don't have croissants, then skiing is just not as fun. Let me
tell you. Okay. I'm learning something new about sports all the time.
And it's I think it's just another game of much to do about nothing. There are 8 rounds, and you're like, the fight for the space is a real... because there are spots where it will reduce the value of the die. So there's always sort of like one space that is free. And then the next ones after is like -1 or -2. So it won't physically reduce the die, but the value of the die is reduced for the power of the action that you're going to take. You have a whole hand of cards, which I played one of. Other players played several. I don't know.
Why did you find the payoff unsatisfying? What about the game made you call it much ado about nothing?
Just because you're constantly just trying to get resources all the time. You're fighting to get resources, and you don't seem to ever get the ones you need, and then you get to do that one thing that costs resources, and it's really not that huge. You know what I mean? You don't feel as though it advanced you in any way, and then you're back at square one of trying to build up your resources again.
So rather than a satisfyingly tight economy, it just felt like a futile economy.
Just so.
That's too bad.
We might get it to the table one more time because it's awfully cute. It's very artistically pleasing. But other than that, the gameplay and the painfulness of the translations make it virtually unplayable. Snow Planner.
That's unfortunate. So played two games back to back. I think one informs the other. First played That's Not a Hat by Casper Lapp. This is one of our favorite party style games of the past few years. We're big fans of Casper Lapp. And I just want to give a piece of advice that in classic traditional old white guy advice is advice that I never follow, but I will like to repeat often and do so in a very stentorious and condescending way. And that is, when you play That's Not a Hat, you have to do it with confidence. Because it can only be a bluffing game if, when you forget, people don't know that you've forgotten and it's not transparent. Now, I never do this. I'm never able to play with confidence. Frequently, when I'm playing That's Not a Hat, I'm gripping the corners of the table with white knuckles. And anytime anyone makes any noise, I say, shut up, I'm trying to concentrate. Because all I have to remember is pizza and trophy, but I have to repeat that to myself over and over and over again so that it makes any sense. So in particular, I was introduced to a new player, and I was showing this person I had just met That's Not a Hat. And they failed at this task spectacularly. Like, it was so bad that they would pull a new card off the top of the deck and immediately have to look at it again. And they just could not maintain any bit of information. I kept trying to tell them, look, what you have to do is just say something with confidence and then you might have a chance. But it was already too late. And then what was striking about this, and the reason why I bring this up, is not so much to make fun of this individual, but then we played Guards of Atlantis 2, our game of the year 2022, about which we regret not at all. Fabulous team-based game. And it's like a switch had been flicked in this person's psyche. They immediately started, I have to say, they were posturing. It was great. It wasn't quite the equivalent of them thrusting out their chest saying, what? Bring it. But it was the kind of hilarious instance where he was just constantly pointing out the abilities of his cards in the most passive-aggressive but nonetheless show-offy way. It's like, oh, just as a reminder, you've just moved into my attack range. I'm just being helpful. Yeah. They were not just being helpful. It was great. I have to say it was great. I this is not a criticism. It was just a marvelous act of performance. I played as Whisper, and I love discovering new characters. I decided to play as Whisper because the last time I played Guards of Atlantis 2, someone else played Whisper, and I really liked how their abilities worked, and I wanted to see it for myself. I was the only one playing a two-star complexity character. It's a little unfair playing a two-star complexity character when the rest of the table is playing a one-star. Not that they're more powerful, but the idea is that everyone should be able to ideally internalize the abilities of the people they're playing against. But I decided to exercise just the privilege of the game explainer, and everyone else played as one star, as I played as a two star. I realize this makes me not the most pro-social individuals, but whatever. I was very curious about how Whisper works. And Whisper is very, very bad at killing people, but very good at setting up teammates to kill people. Especially the build that I gave to Whisper, because Whisper can cause opponents to discard cards a lot and at range. But their actual attacks, not quite as strong. And so there were a number of occasions where I was able to, well, this actually was good for a learning game, like show my teammates and indeed my opponents how player killing works in Guards of Atlantis 2, which is frequently attrition.
So new players that were playing, you got to take away their cards. So they didn't get to actually do anything. So they're having super fun, not only not being able to defend, but when it came to the turn, not being able to play cards. Understood. Okay, go ahead. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead. Continue.
The worst part is, I think you may actually have a point. I was exercising a bit of selfishness as the game explainer. I just wanted that one thing, Walker. Can I have that one thing?
Okay.
Could I have that one thing? Do you give me permission to have a little fun in my life?
I suppose.
In this hobby that's supposed to be about fun?
Yeah, I'm sure their first experience with Guards of Atlantis 2 was fun.
No, actually, everyone enjoyed it. Even at the very second turn, the second action of Guards of Atlantis, people think, oh yeah, this is great. Just understanding how the card system worked and how every action could put you in threat. The difficulty of accomplishing basic actions didn't really frustrate many people. Some people had some difficulty grappling with the way their own character subsystems worked. And in hindsight, I should have remembered that some one-star complexity characters are a little bit more counterintuitive than others. But these are things that I kind of forgot. This was a first time play, 3 versus 3 character game. We played by the recommended intro setup with the exception of the character selection. And overall, it went really well, and people left with a very, very good reception to Guards of Atlantis 2, which is nice because it's a divisive game. A number of people play Guards of Atlantis for the first time and don't want to come back to it, get very frustrated by the difficulty of, as I say, again, accomplishing even simple things is a bit of a, can feel like a bit of a daunting task. But people were understanding the asymmetry, especially in terms of the broader strategic horizons. Like, the other team was mostly pushing minions for the first part. And we as a team looked at the table and said, we're not going to be able to catch up with this. So we're just going to have to accept the fact that we're going to be at level one longer, not get the money, lose the first push, but we're going to kill somebody. We are going to coordinate our efforts and make sure that we're able to bring down on kills. And sure enough, we won on kills as a consequence. Now, it was there was still tension on our side. It wasn't a romp by any stretch of the imagination. It was just a really, really well appreciated, well received first time playing, which is exactly what you want when trying to introduce people to a very brilliant but very counterintuitive and sometimes very difficult to play well game like Guards of Atlantis 2. So I was very pleased with the overall experience, even while watching my colleague, my partner, who in That's Not a Hat immediately get daunted by the first little drawing of a pizza, suddenly become this weird alpha male at the table. It was really quite interesting, psychologically speaking. So that was Guards of Atlantis 2.
We got to play Iberian Gauge, designed by Annabelle Holland and put out by Capstone Games. It is a cube rails game, and I haven't played a ton of them. But the unique parts about this is you sort of can piggyback off of other rail systems. And so you sort of lease the track, and that puts more money into their coffers. So a lot of these train games have their own sort of bank for each sort of line that is out there. And this particular game seemed to have a lot more cooperation in it than other cube rail games.
I'd say collusion.
Collusion.
Yeah.
Because of that particular part, it's like, okay, well, you know, we have this blue line, but we're also in the orange line. So if we use this blue line to piggyback off of a bunch of the blue lines, this will put money in the blue line's coffer, which is practically empty, and will allow us to get to where we need to go. Because there are certain, the turn sequence sort of goes like, you know, invest in rails and then two phases of building rails and then back to invest. And in each of those building rail segments, Each track must get to a city.
The stock price tumbles.
Or the stock price goes down. So there's a lot of sort of figuring out how much track you have left, how much money there is left, how much of the game is left, all on top of trying to get ahead of each other.
Absolutely. There was another aspect of the development of Iberian Gauge that I thought was really interesting. Above and beyond the collusion, there was the overall dynamic of which railroads are appealing and when. Frequently in cube rails games, I too don't have a whole lot of experience with cube rails games, but I have very much appreciated every time I played them. But sometimes in rail games, there's kind of a failure to thrive situation where the railroad isn't really all that appealing, doesn't really leave the starting block, and can get ignored, and then mostly is just predated upon or used and exploited for a very, very quick and low return. It's like, oh, nobody cares about that, so I guess it's super cheap. I'll put in a little bit of money and turn it over for a little bit of profit. But in Iberian Gauge, the way it works is every stock round, there's a full payout for every share sold or unsold. And unsold shares, the money goes right back to the treasury. So that railroad, in particular, in this case, it was the Maroon Railroad, started out in the middle of the map, wasn't very profitable, wasn't very appealing for most of us, was ignored for much of it. But then when the second or third stock round came around, we looked at the treasury and said, oh, it's got a lot of money in there for no good reason. Okay. And the stock price had been tumbling over the course of the rounds because it was so unappealing. And suddenly it was a great purchase, not for a quick turnaround, but for a long-term investment as well. And that development, I thought, was particularly fascinating in the context of cube rails because it was so different from the other ones that I played, like Irish Gauge, like Wabash Cannonball. And I very much appreciated how the economy developed, how the economy breathed, and on top of those opportunities for collusion that you identified, which really affected not just the map state, but also the financial fates of all the relevant railroads.
Yep, and I love that there's very limited number of stocks and it's different for every turn of track, and you get payouts for every time you buy a share, and you get to build tracks every time you have a share. It's sort of like when the build track phase goes down, you go down the sort of who has stocks in it line, and every time your cube comes up, you get to build a track or not. And that also led to interesting sort of gameplay where it's like, well, this person has more stocks in it, I'm just going to pass and not allow them.
Force them to do it because yes. I want the railroad to do well, but not too well because they are more invested than I am. And so there's no reason to have me make this railroad thrive. I just want it to survive. Absolutely.
Yeah. And I'm interested to see how it turns out with different player counts. Because in ours, it seemed to wash out a lot because a lot of the trains, it was like everyone has one stock. Everyone has one stock. No, it wasn't exactly like that.
Right.
But it was close.
And yeah, so there was there was a lot of duplication in terms of portfolios. And the differences, those cleavages, those interesting deltas might have been increased with fewer players. We played with a full complement of five.
Yes. Like you said, with fewer players, more people would be invested in one particular rail.
And it would also be the case, I would imagine, it's strange because I looked it up, on BoardGameGeek, people say that Iberian Gauge, the ideal player count is five, which I found somewhat surprising.
Interesting.
Because another thing that I'd be curious to see with fewer players is that the later stock purchasing rounds might be more dynamic, because in the last stock purchasing round, there was precisely one share of one stock available, and so it was entirely perfunctory. And if there was a little more room in the stock market, you would see more interesting late-term investment, I would imagine, or at least I'd be curious to see.
And also, like we said, the last term was also much more like paperwork, because there was so little track left for people to build and or places they could go. It was just sort of, well, this is sort of what's going to happen, so let's, you know, and we sort of just advance to the end.
Right. Which is not to say that it was too anticlimactic, but it was definitely the kind of thing where there could have been more interesting moves to be had, and I think there would have been more room to do that had there been fewer players. I'm curious to see. I'm very much curious now to try other Cube Rails games by Emma Bell Holland. Dual Gauge is divisive, so is Dinosaur Gauge, but those are both things that I'd be interested in trying. I love Cube Rails games. In terms of the time commitment to economic interest that they develop, I think they as a rule, they're extraordinary, certainly the more modern ones.
True, and how the board state develops over the game, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. And if anything, Iberian Gauge is more flexible than a lot of the other Cube Rails games, because unlike a lot of 18XX games or some of the other Cube Rails games, when a railroad starts in Iberian Gauge, it starts in any major city that you want. And so not only just which railroads start where, but which major cities don't have railroads starting in them will really change the board state on top of the variable initiative order of the different railroads. Because there are definitely fixed board patterns that develop in Cube Rails games. This is not an objection. Again, they tend to be very quick, and it's mostly about the economic action. But just the opportunities for the geography to be so much more variant really appeals to me. So it was a very promising first play. Looking forward to trying Iberian Gauge again, as I say. Looking forward to trying other Cube Rails designs by Emma Bell Holland. As a general rule, I will never turn down the chance to try a new Cube Rails game. The problem is, it's at least locally, it's a bit of a divisive market, because the people who like trains don't like money. And the people who like money don't necessarily like trains.
Well, there's railways of the world, right? Where there's not so much of a stock market. It's a cube delivery system.
Yeah, but it's not a Cube Rails game. It's a very different kind of vibe. But yeah, you're right. There is a certain degree of enthusiasm for Railways of the World. Louis was a little disappointed, actually, when he learned that it was a rail game, and he discovered that this is a rail game where you can't go into debt.
Yes.
Because that's his primary experience. And, you know, Age of Steam and its derivatives, the first thing you do is you just go into a whole bunch of debt. So different strokes. Yeah, Iberian Gauge. I was glad to see that my predictions were true, because I said at the outset, it's like, okay, we start with 40 pesetas. This isn't the kind of game where you're going to win with a score of like 68 pesetas or something like that. You're going to have many, many multiples of your money by the end of the game. And sure enough, the winner had what, a factor of 10 almost? So there you go. I'm always nervous about trying to give people a sense of what the economy is going to look like in a game that I haven't played before, so as to calibrate expectations. And I was pleased that I was able to do a reasonably good job in the context of Iberian Gauge.
Let's go right into Medici after that last statement, because that's the same sort of thing. It's one of those games where it's an open auction. You can like start bidding at whatever you want and sort of setting the stage for newer players of what you should be bidding.
Right.
Should be sort of explained at the beginning. You start with 30 victory points and or money, and then the lots are start to be displayed, and you have to decide, you know, how much your opening bid is going to be, and sort of explaining what that should be so you're not wasting all your money right in the first turn is a good start.
Yeah, Medici is interesting though, because unlike Raw, I would say, the economy of Medici is a little more flexible. Like, for example, I can point to various lots in Raw and be able to state definitively, like, that was not a good bid, or that was too much, or that was too little. But in the context of Medici, It's one of those auction games where you really do have to start making calculated risks about what the round is going to look like in the way the economy is going to shake out. You have to make calculated risk decisions in Raw as well. They're fascinatingly similar games. It's just whether an opening bid of 4 or 8 makes sense in a lot of Medici depends on a lot, and a lot of it is based on risk. And I just want to stress, you said it was an open auction. That is true descriptively. Formally, though, it is a once-around auction. True, it's true. Not like the...
I meant open as you can start exactly. The bid at whatever.
The values are open, not as opposed to the structure of the auction. So what did you think of Medici? This is the first time playing, right?
Yeah, I thought it was great. I think with different people, it might be awful.
How so?
Well, because you can really, like you just explained, you can really calculate what a bid should be. Like, you can stop and take the time and see where everybody is on the track and see, you know, how many cards people have, because there are 5 different goods. And when you win a lot of goods, you're going to go up on all those tracks. And all the cards have a number at the bottom. So if you have the most value in your boat, because you can only have 5 cards, then you get a big amount of points.
You fear card counting is what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I do a little bit of card counting. Like, I care how many cards are left in the deck. But you're right. Past that, I don't start figuring out. It's like, okay, has the 4 of swords already been dealt?
Or that even just evaluating the bid itself. It's like, okay, well, this will get me on this, forward on that track. And if I'm forward on that track, then that'll be 10 points. And then that might get me, you know, ahead on the most ships. So that's another 30 points.
The calculations are pretty straightforward. Yeah. I mean, 10 points to be the top of the track, 30 points if you win the round in terms of value. That's like.
Well, I just mean like for every single auction, though. If you're calculating everything, it'd be kind of like,
Fair enough. I mean, but then again, I prefer auctions where there's a certain, it's the style of play that I prefer, right? Although I enjoy strategic games and I enjoy some amount of calculation sometimes, if a game is going to be pure economics like it's going to be in Medici, I prefer that some of it just has to be based on a heuristic evaluation of risk. And if you're playing it fewer than 6 players, I think Medici scales marvelously for what it's worth. It scales from 3 to 6. If you're playing with fewer than 6 players, though, part of the deck is going to be buried every round, and it's a different section of the deck, and so you don't know. And so it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to engage in the extreme form of card counting that I'd be afraid of, like, has the 4 of swords come out yet? You don't know if the 4 of swords is in the deck.
Yeah.
So you have to make these slightly more gut decisions about what something is worth, and that's, by and large, how I like to do economic games.
Yeah, it's super easy to teach, quick to start. Another Reiner Knizia, fantastic auction game. I'd play it anytime.
I'm curious about the new edition. I remember back, 15, 20 years ago, the real Knizia hobby heads would love to get like all the different editions of Medici and compare them all and things like that. And even then, there were tons of different editions of Medici. Now there are even more. Thankfully, there was a reprint a few years ago in a somewhat minimalistic form. I've seen big box versions of Medici. No.
Well, are there lots of modules that...
No, they're just bigger than they need to be. There's no good reason for it. All you need is a score track, 5 tracks, and a deck of cards. That's it.
Yep. And that the board that we had was much bigger than it needed to be as well.
It's true.
Yep.
It could have been smaller. But the box is not ostentatiously large, so there's that at least. Yeah, we played the lui-même French edition. This was from 2005. There have been many, many editions since, many editions before that. I've never played a bad one. There was an edition that a number of people played with. I believe it was the Amigo version that was then reprinted into Rio Grande that people hated the graphics of. But taste is subjective, and I've never played on that one. So there you have it.
Medici.
Medici by Reiner Knizia, originally published in 1995. I got to show Walker Catan Starfarer's Duel. Now, this is a re-edition of Starship Catan, which was originally published in 2001. I was never a huge fan of all these naming conventions because there's Catan, obviously, and then there was Starfarers of Catan, and then there was Starship Catan. What's the relationship between the two? There aren't really. Some graphic assets were reused, some of the vague theming was preserved, but they were very different games, and Starfarers is a multiplayer game, and Starship Catan is a 2-player-only, mostly card-driven game. And now they've republished it in... as Catan Starfarer's Duel.
They even throw Northwind. There was a game that came out that called Northwind. It was sort of a sailing ship edition that was very similar, had very similar sort of tropes to it. But anyway, I started throwing that.
And somehow managed to be desperately unsatisfying.
Yes.
I was so hopeful for that, especially since the pieces were so nice. You got to build a little cardboard ship.
Yep.
That just wasn't very good. So Starfarer's Duel is pretty far removed from Catan. The fundamental formula that it preserves from Catan, which I thoroughly enjoy, is the basic combination of goods. Just the fact that there's an economy that consists of about five-ish goods, and then in various combination, those goods will buy you various things, some of which will directly give you points, some of which will indirectly give you points. That doesn't sound like a whole heck of a lot, but honestly, it's enough of a connective tissue, and that's the part of Catan that I've always liked. You know, it's very popular, I think, especially amongst contemporary hobby board gamers, to look down their noses at Catan. And I've got my problems with Catan, but it has nothing to do with the fundamental economy. It has nothing to do with the fundamental aspect of how you buy things. The only beef that I have with basic Catan is that the game engine can stall by virtue of the random introduction of goods. In a context like Starfarer's Duel, or a lot of the other Catan offshoots, or the Catan two-player card game, where the introduction of resources is somewhat modified, and you have the rest of the stuff, I really tend to enjoy those systems. And the way Starfarer's does it is it introduces a pseudo-memory element that I think actually really works. I appreciate it. Walker's giving me the stink
face.
That's a stink face.
It works.
Stink face.
It's just memory games. Oof.
Yeah, because what you have to do, broadly speaking, is, again, you can engage in heuristics, and that's totally the level that I appreciate it at. You vaguely remember that Sector 1 is the one where there are a couple of goods that are available for cheap, so you go there when you want to buy stuff. You kind of remember that Sector 2 has that victory planet as opposed to the other victory planets, and you should have a rough idea about where to go to sell your trade goods. Things of that nature. Now, obviously, if you have a better memory and you memorize more of the composition of the sector decks, you're going to do better. But every round, you're going to go a certain distance based on the strength of your engines and on your resource roll, and you get to go through that many random cards off a sector. And sometimes you're specifically hunting for things, and sometimes you're just, oh, I don't know, let's see what's over here. And so you get a little bit of exploration, a little bit of the thrill of discovery, either initially because nobody's seen those cards or because you've forgotten. And I really appreciate that aspect. It's just enough of a vaguely adventure-y, explore-y feel that I think injects a lot of interest into the fundamental formula that I already think is solid. And on top of that, like any good Catan game, you get to buy a whole bunch of toys with those combination of resources and yourself out.
Yeah, you get to customize your own ship. You have your engines. Like Mark said, you sort of have to offset how many cards you're going to flip versus how many actions you can take with those cards. So you're passing. It has this galaxy trucker feel where there are pirates in these decks that we were talking about. And so you sort of have to start putting weapons on your ship and then sort of guess whether or not you're going to have enough strength to beat the pirates off. Anyway, I enjoyed it. I really enjoyed Catan Starfarer's Duel.
Have you played the Catan card game, which has been renamed a bunch of times over the years?
I have not.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that too. And they're some of my favorite iterations of the Catan series. It's strange. Look, again, I understand why people don't like Settlers of Catan, and I share some of those misgivings, but the wholesale rejection of anything with Catan in the title amongst contemporary hobby gamers, I find a little bit strange. And I think that Starfarer's Duel is a very interesting, solid two-player card game that I have very good memories of back from the early aughts when I was starting in the hobby. And I think it's held up pretty well. It's perhaps a touch longer than it wants to be. And I think there can be contexts in which, the end game is pretty evident before things roll around. But I still enjoy going through the sector deck, seeing what I find, buying low and selling high. You do that instead of trading. Two-player games with trading don't tend to work too well as a general rule anyway. And so I think it leverages a lot of the strengths. And as I say, thematically, you do get a certain sense of exploration and adventure. Let me just put it this way. And this is a strange comparison, but I just want to... I think it emphasizes my point. I think that Catan Starfarer's Duel does exploration far better than Eclipse does. It's like flip over a whole bunch of sectors. Oh, guess what? You're not going to be doing well in this 3-hour game.
Yep. Oh, your game's over in the first turn. Yeah. Yikes, that's too bad.
Maybe the second.
Okay.
So that's Catan, Starfarer's Duel. This was designed by the late, great Klaus Tuber and in conjunction with his son, Benjamin Tuber, published last year by Cosmos.
I got Mythwind back to the table. This is designed by Nathan Liege and Brendan Castell, published by Open Owl Studios, and this is the first time I played it with another player at the same time. So Huey was playing the Ranger while I was once again playing the Farmer. And it made it a little bit more interesting. You could bounce off, like there's a sort of an adventure deck that you can go to as an action. And there's also the event deck that you're going through. So you can sort of like read out and jointly choose how it's going to go. There's these forest sprites that, you know, you're interacting with and things happen. You're building buildings. And then, like I said, once again, it's just a whole bunch to do about nothing. There's like, don't get me wrong, there's not much. There's more of a mini game there that you're doing yourself, just an efficiency puzzle. That is what Mythwind is. And the pieces are so enjoyable to interact with. It's just very well produced. You're the farmer, you're doing these Tetris things of keeping like crops together and trying to have them watered and sell them and trying to keep a cycle of that going all the time. Like having something not watered and something there because you're getting these free actions all the time. And if all your stuff is watered and you get a free water action, well, guess what? You've wasted that. So trying to, you know, just action efficiency all the time, that kind of thing. And lots of the other, you know, there's an innkeeper that I'm going to try out next. And there's a crafter, all these different interesting little mini games you can play.
Is it Cozy Walker?
It is very cozy, Mark. You just sort of sit back and zero player interaction. You can't even share money. And it actually makes the game worse when you play with another player because all they're doing is blocking. Because the first thing you do is you take an action in the town. And if someone took that action, then you don't get to take it. So you have to take something else because there's actual blocking. So
solid design choices
when,
in the
when
co-op.
You play by yourself, then you can take whatever action you like.
It is less cozy when you introduce other people because suddenly they get in the way.
That's right.
Very nice.
Damn people.
I think Sath wrote a review of Mythwind. He said hell is other people. I think he was talking about that. I can't remember.
I think so. Something like that.
Those are the games we played last week. Now a brief break while we pay some bills. This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received was actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools, too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code ABOUTGAMES at incogni.com/aboutgames. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
And we're back. And on to the news and why it doesn't matter. Star Realms news. It's going to be the Star Realms 10th anniversary, and they're going to do a somewhat deluxe edition, like maybe one that actually has score trackers, they claim this time, instead of the various card solutions that you have to do for the two-player only deck builder game. And there's going to be a Star Trek edition. Star Trek, Star Realms, the Realms of Trek, or the Trek to Realms, I'm not really sure.
Trek the Realms.
Yeah, and they say that it's exactly the same, as the base Star Realms game. It's just now it's a Star Trek theme. I don't know how I feel about that. I mean, I like Star Trek.
Star Trek! Well, we like the art for Hidden Leaders and Almost Innocent. There's going to be a new game. It's called Yield, Battle for Oscra. Has the same art. Seems somewhat interesting. It's on going to be on crowdfunding. Probably read the rulebook.
On the topic of crowdfunding, right now from Bitewing Games, we have two new designs from Reiner Knizia up on Kickstarter. Iliad and Ichor, two-player games. And part of the challenge with Reiner Knizia lately is you never really know which Reiner's going to show up. But his recent output, there have been some really good games recently that Reiner Knizia has designed. And he's also done things that are, you know, solid but unremarkable. And it's tough to tell which one's going to be which. And I'll probably read the rules. And Knizia two-player gaming action, which used to be his what he was primarily associated with, like back in the heyday of Lost Cities and Lord of the Rings, The Confrontation. He was known for his two-player games, but he hasn't really done that much lately in that sphere. So it's interesting to see him return. And I'm curious to see how it shakes out.
It's all crowdfunding news. That's how slow the news cycle is.
It's true.
My crowdfunding news is there's a game coming out called Imperial Borders. This is a post-Napoleonic game for 2 to 6 players by Larry Harris, the designer of War Room and Axes and Allies. So another massive, giant, dry erase sort of write your orders out on boards.
And a big folding folio for your order. Yeah, it's wild.
A huge crowdfunding project for games that are almost impossible to get to the table.
Yep. This time, though, this particular game, we'll talk more about it in Pledge of Indifference, I have no doubt. But this particular design, I will try to help you get it to the table. No guarantees, though, because it is going to be a daunting task, but you'll have my assistance.
All right. That's Imperial Borders. Check it out.
That is the news and why it doesn't matter. On to our feature game. Feature game is Fate Forge, Chronicles of Khan, designed by Gordon Kalea, published by Mighty Boards this year, pursuant to successful crowdfunding. We played a pre-production version of this game back before when it was on crowdfunding, and Gordon Kalea is the designer of Vengeance, which is a local swag favorite, a dice-driven game about fueling a revenge movie, and he also helped co-design Vengeance, Roll and Fight, one of our favorite real-time dice rolling games. Walker, why don't you give us an unhelpful summary about what one does in Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan?
Well, it's sort of just going back to basics for sort of dungeon delving, campaign fighting games. The map setup is fairly quick. You put out some map tiles that you need to form the map. You put out some discs for the enemies. There's a giant deck of cards that even though it's the same type of enemy, sort of his skills might be mixed up a little bit.
Yeah, maybe the stats.
Maybe an extra hit point, maybe a different type of skill. And then you're right into the game. It has this interesting sort of initiative system where all the enemies are going to go at the end, some sort of break up in the middle. And so it forms this nice little line where you get to decide to go. Anyway, roll the dice, take your actions, enjoy it very much. Fate Forge.
So it's app-driven. It's an app-driven campaign game, which is absolutely two strikes against it. I still don't enjoy app-driven games. I recognize that there is a virtue to it and that there's some flexibility. I will say that the app does seem to add some value overall. It's not merely a detriment because it is tracking things that would be difficult to track or impossible to track secretly in the context of a campaign.
Well, that's, you know, truth to tell. We'll see how that washes out. Like,
yes.
If some fancy stuff happens as we play through it, because I imagine, you know, spoilers, we're going to keep playing it, that if some of these things come back and a lot of these decisions that we've made are being saved and cultivated in the background of the app, then all the power to it, I guess.
Yes, there's already been some things. Like, it tracks how many successful encounters you have and how many successful checks you have of various types. And it cares about that in a sense. But yes, I'm hoping that there's going to be more substantial payoff in terms of remembering narrative beats that have occurred rather than just a more flexible way of doling out campaign structure. I mean, yes, I realize that if you plot programmatically out all the different permutations of success and failure for various scenarios, as well as, considering all the volume of information from side missions that a, say, a scenario book would have to say, we're talking about considerable burdens, both in terms of the people making it and the people using it. So again, I recognize that there's some virtue in the app. I just don't like staring at my phone while engaging in a board game. I will say that my other fears and my other concerns about app-driven games, which were present in the pre-production version, are not present here. One of them being that it chews up your battery like a puppy with a corner of a rug. So I'm grateful that this one... And the other thing is that I had to, in the context of playing with the pre-production version, I had to reset the campaign 3 different times because of errors. Either the app crashed at the wrong time, or an input wasn't registered properly and there was no way to undo it, or a variety of other things. I hated that app by the end of the experience. So far, there have not been problems like that in the final version of the Fateforge app.
And something has to be said for the sort of saving the game state, right? It's much easier. There's a lot of campaign games where you have to sort of retrack where you are and what's going on with the app, and plus how simple the components are and how they allow you to, you know, stow them away makes coming back to the game super easy.
That is true. Generally speaking, a lot of the design and production choices in terms of the physicality of components has been done very well. So as Walker mentioned, the enemies are represented by discs. So you get to have, you know, full color art, and they're wooden discs. So they're, you know, nice to manipulate, and they're all just stored in a box with a little legend on the box lid about what to find and where. So getting them out is much easier than, say, organizing a lot of monster types that you would find in other similar type games, be they campaign or no. Similarly, there's a box for every character and a box for the overall campaign state. So you can just throw things in the box. And then when it's time to set up the next scenario, just dump out the box and it's mostly already set up for you. And so I very much appreciate that it seems that overall the design is conscientious. All of this so far, though, is largely in terms of mitigating things I hate in the format. We've been very clear, and for me especially over the past couple of years, there's been serious campaign fatigue and a disinclination towards just the sheer burden of committing to these kinds of things. Now, I will note that in theory, Fateforge Chronicles of Khan is eventually going to have a standalone one-off mode called Battle Mode, where you can just set up a one-shot and go play that. This is not yet live. They have not updated the app to allow for this, so I'm vaguely curious about that. In terms of the actual gameplay, let's move on to that. What are your thoughts, Walker?
I think it's great. I'm just going to go over it so people can sort of put in context, you know, what we're talking about. Everyone rolls their 4 dice. No matter what items that you get in the future or anything else, it's always 4 dice. So you might have items that let you give you access to fancier dice or different colored dice, but you choose 4. You roll them in secret. And then you sort of discuss how the turn is going to go. You set your initial order then, and the app will tell you when 2 random unit types are going to act. And then at the end of that complete round, all the enemy unit types will act. And then you'll sort of go down the line. And then the first player just sort of reveals their dice, and they sort of do what you do in almost the Vengeance and the dice game.
Similar to Vengeance.
You have all these little recipe cards that are skills that you can use those that require certain combinations of dice, or the dice themselves can give you actions as well, like either just normal stabs or shoot or other things. And it's very quick and so smooth, and that's pretty well how it goes. And then the enemies will interrupt with their 2 actions. The rest of the players will go. Then all the enemies will do what they do. And something's to be said for that, because every card explains what they will do when they activate. And it's very easy to follow, and the flow is real.
Absolutely. And I do like the dynamic between the enemies activating at the end of the round, which is all very straightforward and transparent, and a little bit of uncertainty in the reaction system. Because as you said, 2 specific enemies will do something, and it will typically be similar to what they do at the end of the round, but not exactly the same. So you're not going to see the bruiser guard type character, you know, move very far or shoot suddenly or do things of that nature, but you don't know for certain how they're going to behave. They're going to behave roughly as expected given their character, their class archetype, but it's not necessarily going to be exactly the same as the AI at the end of the round. And so I think that the balance between ease of execution and uncertainty has been nailed to an almost perfect degree. One thing I do want to circle back to is, though, you said, you know, you roll your four dice and then you get to start possibly manipulating them with your recipes. I, thus far, we've finished Act 1 of Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan. Act 1 of 3. I, thus far, am a little disappointed at the rate at which those additional skills have entered the system, because the level of manipulation of your dice is a touch lower than I would like it to be. There's still a lot of choices to be made about how to use the dice that you've rolled. But unlike traditional dice-driven systems, usually there are like built-in reroll elements, and there's a fair amount of manipulation of the dice before you actually start resolving them. And although the fundamental Vengeance/Fateforge system has more interest in terms of using the dice that you've achieved, I wish there was just a touch more in terms of massaging your dice results than exist. There are some tools that everyone has access to. You can spend a fatigue. You can spend a fatigue to reroll all your miss results once. Stuff like that. I just wish there was a little bit more.
Yeah, there are. If you roll three of the same symbol, you can turn one of them to whatever you want. There are a lot of skills that you have that will manipulate dice into other dice.
Not a lot of skills. That's the thing. Like, not a lot of skills. You start off with two. Not all of them are dice manipulation skills. And acquiring new ones through money is one of the chief ways, almost the only way, to sort of level up your character. And that relates to one of my long-term concerns that I think the app has served to allay but not fully address, and that is the possibility of a death spiral. Because, this is good news overall, we lost one scenario badly. And then we were looking at the fact that we had barely any money. You spend money to heal, and you also spend money to level up. And the concern that was running through my head was, okay, well, we weren't good enough already, and now we're going to have to spend a whole bunch of money just trying to survive. And that is going to prevent us from leveling up further. Where do we go from here? And I think, it's hard to be certain, but I think what the app did was looked and said, you guys are pathetic. Here, have some cash. And so it was very much appreciated. And I assume that partially, at least in part, that was the app rubber banding things for us.
True. I think that it has two things that are sort of pushing up, two good things that are pushing up against each other. There's one where you can sort of reduce how much damage you're taking because it's very puzzly. Some of the monsters won't move depending how far away they are from you, or
right,
they'll attack. And so you can sort of puzzle it out. If we push this person here, or we move past them, or we get this far away, it's very puzzly that way.
Yes.
But the problem with that is that the battles tend to only last three rounds.
Yes.
So in order to utilize that puzzle, you sort of have to, you know, do it in a way that is not always to your benefit. So it sort of counteracts each other.
Well, it depends on the scenario you're playing. So let's talk a little bit about the different scenarios we've played. As you say, typically a scenario will last three rounds, which is very, very, very tight. And I feel that tightness.
Well, I just want to be clear. Instead of saying the last three rounds, there's a time limit of three rounds.
Right.
Yeah.
You can go to a fourth at the cost of a pretty serious detriment. So you're encouraged to get it done in three rounds. And you don't heal up to full at the end of every round. Again, you have to pay for it. And so what this does is it leads to feeling they're very, very tight and there's not a whole lot of room for error. And you feel like you're balanced on the knife edge of complete disaster. I like this, and it helps keep things moving. It helps for the pacing. But again, I feel that sometimes I feel like a little bit more room for either experimentation or a little bit more room for the scenarios to breathe might have been appreciated. But then again, had that been done, I might have felt that the game was not proceeding at a good enough pace. So it's tough to tell. All of that having been said, there is now a particular scenario type. We're not going to get into too many details. It's not spoiler territory. But there's a particular scenario type that I thus far very much don't enjoy. And that is the type where you have to take down a particular target that is very rapidly on the move. And so far, I found them very frustrating. Not hard, not tight, but frustrating. And you feel like you're just never making progress if things aren't going well. And there I feel like that knife edge where things were tight and satisfying and moving along, and maybe you might have liked things a little bit looser, but you can see why things work that way. Those encounters, I don't really enjoy very much. What were your thoughts?
Well, there was the one where we should have anticipated that that was going to happen. Because, yeah, I guess I don't want to go into so much spoilers. Because I should just, maybe we can just say, the way the map was laid out.
Sure.
We should have made the inference that this was going to happen this way and maybe been ready for that, maybe. I'm not sure. But those kind of things, especially when you're so limited in the round structure and I believe the fun part is puzzling out how to not take so much damage to avoid the grindiness, that those type of things where it takes that out even further because now you have to chase these people through the map is not very enjoyable.
Yeah. I think the scenarios in Fate Forge are working to their strengths when, now this could just be personal play style because this is how I play games. This is how I play skirmish games. When it's a little bit more in terms of at a stately pace where you're like, okay, go and clear the area so as to be safe. Go and clear the area to be safe, especially since every wound you take is potentially a permanent burden in terms of the overall arc of Fate Forge. I don't appreciate it when something like, okay, get a move on. You better run through all these enemies. Like, oh, geez. So it's tough to tell. And I will also note that there was one scenario in particular that none of us really appreciated.
I was going to say, most of it has been good news.
Yes. Yes. But it's worth emphasizing the bad as well.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm saying it. And it was like right today. So like, yeah. Had we not played today, this would have been all glowing stuff for within reason.
The criticisms I have are still apply, I think. But
then there's this one scenario. Let's pretend everyone has gathered for a D&D game. And the dungeon master says, well, for this particular night, only one of you is going to go on the adventure. The rest of you will sit and just listen to us talk. How fun would that be?
That doesn't sound like a good idea. I don't think that should happen.
No. I don't think anyone's designing a D&D scenario like that. and I think for good reason, Mark.
Yeah. It was a chase scenario where only one player gets to play.
So the app shows you a picture of all the characters that you've decided to use in this particular campaign, and it says, choose one that will go on this mission, and then they play an entire dungeon by themselves.
An entire scenario, yeah. Yeah. Now, again, the scenarios are reasonably quick and reasonably tightly designed, but it's still an entire scenario, set up, play, tear down, where only one player is participating. This is baffling to me. I don't understand who thinks this is a good, who wants this. I don't know what playgroup wants this. I don't know what player, like if you're playing solo and you're two-handing with two characters, fine. But the app knew that we're not playing solo. The app knew that there were three of us and the app was like, no, two of you are sitting this out.
And then the stress on that one person.
It's not pleasant for anyone.
No.
Yeah, no. Utterly, utterly baffling. So let's talk a little bit about the narrative elements, because I think they're worth discussing. I remember the narrative elements of the pre-production version to be uninspired. And I have to say that so far in the final version of Fate Forge Chronicles of Khan, I am very pleasantly surprised.
They are. The names and the places, they go a little overboard.
Too many proper nouns, too much punctuation on those proper nouns, umlauts aplenty, sedillas, accents, you name it.
And then repeating them.
Yep.
Constantly. But that's just grammar part. But the actual story is very good.
Yeah. Part of me wonders if that's just because Fate Forge is a pre-existing universe. There's a role-playing system. They're trying to spin out other stuff. It's like franchising opportunities.
True. Right? Yeah. I guess we should be happy that there's not TMs after some of these.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. It's just in terms of the fact that I want this to be a relatively standalone experience, whatever. So the overall setting is a kind of a fish out of water setting, which is great. If you're going to be doing fantasy or science fiction or any kind of speculative fiction, really, fish out of water is a great way to make sure that there's a sense of discovery and that a way to carefully manage out exposition. And I think that Fate Forge had leveraged that very, very well. Your characters are basically emissaries from the forest, from the Styx, who are being threatened by an empire. And there's this really cool dynamic where the immortal emperor, the god king of this empire, is beloved by his people. But to you, he's a potentially world-ending conqueror. And that dynamic is great. It's an era, there's a little bit of paranoia, there's a little bit of tension, and it's just a little more interesting and complicated than, oh, here's the big, oppressive, evil emperor who's about to come stomp on your face. No, well-liked, supported by his people, and has, by everyone's acknowledgement, done good things for his people. And that dynamic is just much more textured than a lot of the ones you see. And it's leveraged well in the context of Fateforge. I'm enjoying it.
Yep, I agree. Gameplay, everything about it, except for that last scenario, very enjoyable.
I would say in terms of the gameplay, I enjoy almost all of it. I wish that, again, a little bit like Vengeance and a little bit like Vengeance Roll and Fight, there was a little bit more rapid introduction of special abilities, but I get it. This is one of the casualties of a campaign structure. You've got to pace the unlocks.
True, and it's not as painful as Sleeping Gods, right? Where you know, we're sort of explaining it the same way, but it's not the same. It's not as though you're wasting actions and time recuperating and doing things. You're right into the next scenario, but you're just a little weaker and a little more cautious because you have less hit points than the last time.
There are a lot of games, a lot of narrative games, where they try very much to cover up the fact that it's just a whole bunch of meters of tritting. And very often, I just completely bounce off of those systems because they don't do a good enough job, and all that I see is just a series of numbers going down in a spreadsheet. And I definitely felt that way about Sleeping Gods. At its worst, I start to see those systems starting to emerge in Fateforge, but most of the time, I am kept up in the story and the tactical choices. And that is something that I haven't said about this structure of game for a long time. I've been enthusiastically going back to Fateforge Chronicles of Khan for session after session, multiple sessions in one sitting, because the scenarios are quick and it keeps it moving. And this is something I would not have expected me to feel even, say, a few months ago. And so on those terms, I think that Fateforge Chronicles of Khan is a bit of a triumph.
Yeah, that is the balance in Fateforge. It is you have one currency, which is money. You're not tracking experience or anything else. And so you're either A, spending that money to bring your health back, or you're spending it on new toys.
Largely, yes, absolutely. And I'm looking forward to seeing where the plot goes. I'm looking forward to getting more abilities. I'm looking forward to seeing new enemy types. I'm looking forward to seeing new scenarios.
There's one thing we haven't touched on at all. There's also, on top of all this, sort of a map puzzle, right?
Which is another thing I was expecting to hate.
Yes, but was great. It is. It's reminiscent of Micro Macro. You are looking for little clues on the map. The narrative that comes up on the app, it's, you know, says, you know, this is where...
This is what you see around you, this, you find yourself...
Yeah, and this is where you want to go, but it doesn't actually tell you exactly where that is. And so you sort of have to puzzle out which directions to move on the map and the surroundings that you see and other things like that. And I thought it was great.
Yeah, I was vaguely nervous about it, but it turns out that not only is it mechanically satisfying enough, it's also really thematically interesting because it says in the rule book, and it's absolutely true. Again, you're from the sticks, you show up at the city and you have this map and that's it. Like, you don't know how to get from point A to point B necessarily. Ain't no GPS to be had. The Google lady ain't going to tell you where to turn. And so you look around on the map and figure, I think we want to go here. I guess we're going left. And then the app will tell you, oh, you find yourself now in the Grand Marketplace. Now you know where that is. Unlock that key element, remove the sticker, and now you know how to get there. And it's really well done. I'm shocked by how well it works.
It's true. I don't want to say, you know, oh, we play lots of games, so it wasn't so hard. But I would be interested on, like, new gamers moving around the city more randomly and how the app would track that.
I don't even really care about the difficulty level. It's just, it's a flavorful, thematic, evocative way to get from point A to point B, narratively speaking. I'm not talking physically on the map. I just mean narratively. And it really helps sell that this is a strange place that's very big and full of lots of things. And we don't necessarily know what we're doing. It doesn't matter how capable you are. We're very capable of what we do. We're very good at murdering guards. Yes. Oh my goodness. If your job, it doesn't matter whether the city is paying you or someone else, if your job is to guard something and you see a party from Fateforge Chronicles of Khan roll up, run.
Retire.
time to take that break.
Throw your name tag away.
Because one of the things that Fateforge does, which is a little narratively weird that a lot of games do, both video and tabletop games, is like, oh, you need to go get something from a warehouse? Oh, I guess everyone in there is going to die. It's just a touch strange. But anyway, but I love the map parts. It knows exactly how long those segments should be. It's not cumbersome in terms of components. You just unfold the map and start moving around. And it really sells the fish out of water experience. It's extraordinarily well done. Fateforge, Chronicles of Khan, we are absolutely going to be continuing. That is Act 1. We are going to be giving you updates about future acts as things developed. And we are very pleased to have embarked on this campaign experience. And unlike Dread and Fatigue, which is mostly how I feel about campaign games, Fate Forge is something I'm looking forward to exploring more of.
Agreed.
So that does it for this week. Thank you so much for joining us for So Very Wrong About Games. You can find all our contact information at sowronggames.com/contact. We read everything you send us and we'll get back to you if we can. We hope to see you again soon.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McMahon. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.